versions of this. This is a very good type of tape, incidentally.
Yes. Well, I recommend using a 60-minute tape because that works out.
Oh, that breaks it, yes, it makes it an hour.
But I have some 90-minute tapes we're going to move to if we use this one up, so... But I don't know if you want to take a break at this point? We can always take a break and walk around and stretch our legs and get a drink or do something different.
Well, we can, and I also might like to call my wife,
sure,
who will join us for lunch,
okay,
at that...
Why don't we go ahead and just, you know...
So, for a moment.
So... We just kind of finished discussing this issue with regard to the vapor pressure curves, and actually the fact that much of the work was in literature just was a matter of evaluating it, basically.
Yes, and to develop and to use eventually a computer to help us draw the curves, which was quite an enterprise. And it's amusing that in the first version of it, I had approached the administration asking for computer help, and I checked it out and found that it would cost, I think it was $700. Well, the big boss we had at that time said, no, that's definitely too much. So I drew everything by hand and had it done in the... We had a very good drafting department and had it done clean. So that much for that particular side issue that I mentioned. I had got interested in between in something else, and that was to develop an ultra-high vacuum system, which I did, using liquid helium, which was at that time still quite novel and very cumbersome. So I spent quite a bit of time on designing a ultra-high vacuum system with a small mass spectrometer built in.
Why did you want to have such a system?
Well, there was a great deal of call for ultra-high vacuum, and it was an interesting exercise to see how far you could push it and see what was left in such a system with a mass spectrometer. So this was using mass spectrometry for ultra-vacuum determinations.
And what year was this?
1962, I see here.
Of course, residual gas analyzers were available by then, I assume.
Yes, but not to that low level.
Right.
And we were going down to 10 to minus 10, 12, something of that order.
So you actually were able to obtain, in terms of vacuum, something that was, those were 10 to the minus 12 atmospheres, torr, millimeters of mercury?
Torr.
Yeah. And what's left?
And what was pressure? Left was hydrogen, as I recall. That's what was left.
So the helium was then a cryogenic?
It was a cryogenic system, yes. Very cumbersome at the time, too, filling it, keeping it full.
Didn't this represent gasketing problems in terms of having effective seals and so on?
Well, this was all gold seal. Sure, this was an all-metal system of gold seals.
Bakeable, I assume?
Highly bakeable. Oh, gosh. We baked the hell out of it. Pardon the expression.
That being 100, 200, 300 C?
400 C easily. 450. Well, 300 is mild. But that was definitely a little side project that I did.
So in the materials characterization area, you moved on to the semiconductor materials at this point.
Well, yes, that's what was of interest. And then, as I said already...
Of course, you had a group working for you by...
Well, yes. As I prefer to say, they were working with me, not for me.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of, I mean, who were the people then that who was like the first people that you collaborated with in some of these things?
Well, I was able to bring in a number of people. Bill Harrington, you may know his name, and later on Charlie McGee.
Where did Harrington come from?
He came from...
Had he been working with Bendix along the way? Is that my imagination?
No, there was not that thing. If you'd asked me these questions 10 years ago, I would have given them to you.
Yeah.
Right like that. He worked with a colleague of mine whom I knew quite well. Where was he?
Was this
he was probably at...
industry or...
No, he was in... at Cornell. Not McLafferty, no.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you offhand, but he came, he was the first one that I was able to bring in. And then later on, Jane Gale. But this was now in 1977, 78, and Brian Benz still later in 1980s.
Well, did like Harrington, was he mostly a physicist or did he have
maybe he had started in chemistry, but he had some experience in mass spectrometry.
Okay. And that was the primary application,
that
they worked?
Well, there was a fair-sized mass spectrometry group, but in addition we did ultraviolet, infrared. We then went into a variety of other things.
Did you do anything like emission spectrograph?
Well, there was an emission spectrograph that we'd had for a long time that was used still quite extensively, yes.
So it had a general analytical flavor?
It was a general analytical group.
With a focus on semiconductor?
Focus on semiconductors.
Was this type of a laboratory unique at that time?
I would say we could be quite, at that time, be quite proud of ourselves. We had about a total of 20, as many as 24 people. Some of them, of course, assistants and senior assistants. A few other areas, and at this point I'm searching. So it might come back to me. So this then became pretty much of a full-time job with a group that size to
yes.
keep things going, and it was very well received at the laboratories.
So you were somewhat in a middle management position at that time. Is that
good? That's right.
Characteristic in the...
Yeah. I was called a group head.
Yeah. But you had, it was not difficult for you to get funding from the from your management.
No, I was quite successful, and I had some intelligent people in the next layer that were very helpful. No, we were, the last phases, we were able to get multi-million dollar funding for up-to-date equipment.
Did you, like, replace the Metropolitan Vickers machine at some time?
We still use it. Yes, we replaced it by a more modern one at one time. The aboriginal 1960 model we sold off for $30,000 to somebody in Denver and got another second-hand one that was more modern. And that was used still a great deal of the time. And then Charles McGee built some very fine Sims equipment that could be rastered. He was a very capable man. It was a fine group. It was, I'd say, a happy group.
So when would you characterize the period when this group of people was like in its heyday? There's probably some, like...
The peak?
In the, what, when it started to become into its own?
Probably, I retired from that job in 1982. It was still, at that time, the peak of its effectiveness.
And you would say that it was making good contributions and starting
it made,
that team?
It was made excellent contributions to the laboratories and was well received.
And it was like in, say, was it in the late 60s when it started to come into its own, or early 70s?
No, well, I only took it over. There was a very rudimentary small group in 66 when I took over. I would say it was in the mid-70s where it began to flourish. Because the build-up was very, very gradual on purpose and by necessity.
So what did you look for in these people? Mass spec experience or physicists or materials background or?
Well, some were interested in mass spectrometry and were interested in knowledge going beyond just the bread and butter stuff. So that particularly always emphasizing that they could and should have a project of their own for part-time, say somewhere between 10% and 20% of their time.
Sounds ideal.
Kept them productive.
Yes. Sounds very nice. So, the emphasis at this point was an overall characterization of these materials and not only mass spectrometry, but any other analytical technique that would provide information that would be necessary in the construction of new devices and so on.
Yes.
As RCA, and what was their, how large of a player were they in the semiconductor business at that time? Do you have any feeling for?
It was still quite successful, I would think. The overall laboratories had been built up to, at one time, was at least 400 technically trained people, plus maybe another among that. We were probably a total population of 1,300, 1,400 people.
So the work continued then in mass spectrometry. What other large projects were attempted then in this phase when you had a full-fledged group working?
Well, the last one was with Brian Benz, that I actively worked with him on it after I handed over the group to Bill Harrington, in fact. Was to use a, and that's the last publication that we put out. What we call an organic SIMS instrument with separate triple stage quadrupoles.
So there was a reasonable amount of instrument design that went on during.
Oh yes, we had some fun. We had some fun indeed. We designed that instrument from the bottom up with completely bakeable ultra-high vacuum system. And I think it's still being used by Brian Benz at this point, who's one of the few people who's still there.
So this, basically in a project like this, to build a piece of equipment up from that stage was require quite a bit of time, I would assume.
Oh yes, well, I was able to devote essentially full time to it, and Brian Benz at the time probably three-quarter time, half-time, three-quarter time.
And you had enough experience from your previous work to be able to avoid a lot of the pitfalls.
We were able to. And of course, equipment, in terms of equipment, there had been tremendous progress with ultra-high vacuum pumps, and so we were able to draw on the experience that had been built up over the years, if not even decades.
I noticed that this last instrument was a quadrupole with an analyzer. That there was some considerations for doing it that way. You abandoned essentially magnetic sector type approach.
Yes, for that purpose, we used quadrupoles, and then of course they were commercial quadrupoles. They were incorporated.
So you bought that technology off the shelf?
We bought that technology off the shelf and then modified it to suit our purposes, yes. And of course things took longer than expected as usual. So
for this triple machine, how could you just kind of walk through the machine from the beginning? If you start out in the first quadrupole, what are you doing in these various sectors?
be better served if I looked at our diagrams at this point. Well, we also did quite a bit of design of the ion paths by using computers, which was a major project to get the ion paths properly designed so that things would focus at the right place onto the right surface.
So how, you kind of indicated that this equipment may even be presently in use by Brian Benz, but the laboratory is considerably reduced in size today compared to...
Well, if you want to go into that sad story, I'll outline it for you quickly. In 1985, to everybody's surprise, the top man of GE, Jack Welch, and our top dog at the time, whose name I have mercifully forgotten, got together without anybody else knowing about it, and RCA was sold to GE for many billions of dollars. GE wasn't slow in demolishing the company. They really wanted NBC. That's all they wanted out of it. And that's another story. RCA had never been willing to sell that. So they were bought stock, lock, and barrel. So then what the question was, what to do with the laboratory? After all, GE had a fine laboratory in Schenectady. No point in having two laboratories. So they were searching around. They were willing to close it up at one time, but they were prevented, actually, by the governor of New Jersey at the time. So eventually, the laboratory was handed over for free to the West Coast Research Organization.
Of General Electric?
No. Forgive me. Don't put that in the...
Well, there'll be an opportunity to correct the...
Palo Alto.
Is it Stanford out there?
Stanford Research Institute.
Oh, okay.
Stanford Research Institute, which is not really connected with Stanford anymore, took it over. And now the laboratory became what you might call a job shop. People, in order to be there, had to bring in very substantial programs. And as a result, the laboratory that existed before 1985 doesn't exist anymore. There have been projects, and most of the people who were there have left. But other people have come in. I have not kept track of it. Initially I did, but it's a rather painful experience. And the man who was selling us down the river. Took us $12 million. Bought himself a personal security man. The sad story is that a year later he died. Such is life.
Well, corporate buyouts are part of the modern...
And this is really one of the first, one of the early takeovers of that type. Not by now, everything is like that. Right here, in this area, the paper company come down the drain everywhere. So, it's the end of an era, all I can see.
I think you're right. When you first started working, did you feel that the management was interested in pursuing good science as well as doing work that was relevant to the company?
They were, because they were well provided for through the resources, the patents that were still active at that time, that paid very good royalties. And the laboratory, when I came in 1950, was fully funded by the royalties. Then, of course, those royalties gradually dried up. And that's at some time around 1960 or so, when we were beginning to strike out and bring in projects, or projects were brought to our attention.
Such as the Air Force.
Such as the Air Force.
Did you do more of these type of things in your materials characterization? Were there other big customers that either came to you or that you solicited business from besides the Air Force?
There might have been some minor ones, surely there were, but the Air Force contract was, in my area, the big item.
Well, why don't we take a different tact here for a while and back up and look at a different aspect of your career. You've been involved in mass spectrometry for quite a number of years, and of course, as you're well aware, there's been this development, a lot of mass spectrometry developed in the organic petroleum end of things. When did you go to your first, at that time, ASTM E14 meeting? Do you recall the occasion of that?
That was in 1946.
Which would have been one of the first meetings.
And went to the meeting, and which was being sponsored by CEC, as I remember. Yes, there were yearly meetings.
Mm-hmm. Was that the one that was held in association with the Pittsburgh Conference in, at that time, or was
there were also Pittsburgh Conference meetings, but I think they were separate.
Okay.
I went to Pittsburgh a number of times.
And you, to a certain degree, even though you were doing mass spectrometry, you were sort of outside of the norm for that group. ASTM E14 is really like a petroleum standards type.
Yes.
Committee, and you weren't. Well, you had done some work in.
Were different committees, and took over one of the committees early on, before we became an organization, which was in 1969, I think. That's when ASMS was plus minus first found it.
But you found, even though most of the people that would have attended an early ASTM meeting were probably petroleum chemists, you found that they were willing to accept you into their fold as a master truck?
No, there were more, there were quite a few people who did basic work. There were people at the National Bureau of Standards, for example, Vernon Deibler, who worked very early on deuterated deuterium compounds, which started